Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Glick. Dr. Glick is going to discuss his research studies on ibogaine and analogs of ibogaine. Dr. Glick received his MD and PhD in pharmacology from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He then climbed the academic ladder quite rapidly, from assistant professor to full professor of pharmacology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. From 1984 to present, he's been professor and chair of the Center for Neuropharmacology and Neuroscience at Albany Medical College. He has more than 280 refereed, peer-reviewed publications with wide-ranging interests in CNS pharmacology. Today, he's going to focus on his work with ibogaine, which he has published on since 1991, and it's with extreme pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Glick.
I don't have to tell you about drug use and drug dependencies. The only reason I put this slide up is to let you know that in the laboratory, we separate the reinforcing aspect of the drug from the withdrawal syndrome that is produced by chronic drug administration. And addiction and physical dependence can occur separately, as I'm sure you know. They must not commonly occur together. In the laboratory, we separate them so we can study them separately in terms of what mechanisms are responsible. Now, there are two things I should tell you about for this talk. Number one, all of my patients are rats, so that may turn a few of you off. The second of all is this presentation was written for PowerPoint 2002, and apparently we only have 2,000, so some of the animation isn't going to work correctly. I probably also don't have to tell you is that addicts are desperate for new therapies. Owing to the miracle of the internet and the rapid way in which information is exchanged, over the last 10 years or so, I've gotten literally hundreds of calls, emails, and letters from addicts or families of addicts, all of whom are desperate and are eager to volunteer for anything that I might have to offer them. So there's a crying need for this. I'm sure you all know this firsthand. I'm going to skip the history of ibogaine. You've already heard this, thanks to Deborah. This was one of the first media reports of ibogaine in a well-known medical journal called The Village Voice. This was about the time that I began to get interested in it. Soon after I started to study ibogaine, which, by the way, was directly attributable to Mr. Lotsoff, who was the first person to tell me about it, but within a couple of years, there were reports that very high doses of ibogaine damaged a part of the brain, namely the vermis of the cerebellum in the rat. Unfortunately, damage was exaggerated well beyond any practical importance. It only occurs with very huge doses, but nevertheless, it generated a lot of unfortunate bad publicity. That, along with some ibogaine-related deaths that occurred around the same time, and I became convinced that this was never likely to be an FDA-approvable drug. Because of that, I started to collaborate with a medicinal chemist, Martin Kuna, at the University of Vermont. And what Dr. Kuna did was he systematically varied the molecule, which, as you see now, is changing a variety of ways. And we were looking for a safer, better ibogaine, essentially a drug which mimicked all the beneficial effects of ibogaine, some of which I'll tell you about, but lacked the side effects. And after about 15 or so compounds, we finally hit on one called 18-methoxycarnaridine, and why the animation keeps going, I don't know. But it's, let's see, maybe we can get it to stop. No, it doesn't want to stop. Anyway, the drug we ended up with was 18-methoxycarnaridine, which we now refer to as 18-MC. Actually, we've tested over 50 such compounds to date, and we have several backup compounds. 18-MC was the first one that looked like it was worth following up, and we have the most data on 18-MC. What we were looking for was a drug that was effective in reducing drug self-administration, which is our animal model of the reinforcing or addicting quality of drugs. And a drug which attenuated withdrawal, opiate withdrawal, which of course you've already heard about, which was claimed to occur in people. To study the self-administration aspect of this, we use rats that have catheters in the external jugular vein, and they're taught to press a lever to self-administer a small dose of a drug of abuse. And we've studied several, including morphine, cocaine, methamphetamine, and nicotine. And what we were looking for, the ideal treatment we were looking for, was a drug which would reduce drug self-administration but which would not affect responding for a non-drug reinforcer like food, water, or sucrose, which rats happen to like a lot. Most of our work has been done used water, and more recently we've been studying sucrose. And what we found with 18-MC, the quality that made us continue studying it, was the fact that 18-MC reduced self-administration of cocaine and morphine in our initial studies, but had no effect on responding for water. In contrast, in the lower right, ibogaine acutely depressed responding for all three. And this really was what led us to continue the pursuit of developing 18-MC as a potential anti-addictive agent. Eventually, we studied its effects on methamphetamine and nicotine self-administration. One of the effects we discovered, which will be relevant in a few minutes, is that 18-MC is most potent in decreasing the self-administration of nicotine. And this was probably a hint of something that we were later to follow up. We also engaged a collaborator, Amir Rizvani, in the University of North Carolina, who had alcohol-preferring rats. There are, by the way, which is relevant to the story of the genetics of alcoholism, there are rats that actually love alcohol, and there are other rats that don't like alcohol. He gave 18-MC to rats that preferred to drink alcohol, and 18-MC worked in reducing alcohol intake as well. The one basic question we eventually answered was just exactly how does 18-MC interact with the drug of abuse? That is it blocking the drug like a pure antagonist would do? Is it perhaps enhancing the effect of the drug so that animals don't have to take as much of it to get the same euphoria? Well, the answer to this question is that what 18-MC does is it shifts the whole dose effect self-infusion curve lower. It pushes the curve down. And what this means is that 18-MC reduces the efficacy of the drug as a reinforcer. Or to put it in, if the rats could talk, what they would tell us is that they feel the morphine, but they just don't like it as much anymore. And that's what we would expect would happen in people, that if they got 18-MC and they then took the drug of abuse, they simply would not get the same kick out of it that they'd gotten previously. We also found that 18-MC, like ibogaine, which we did similar studies with earlier, produced effects that persisted, at least in terms of a rat's lifespan, for a fairly long period of time, for at least 1 to 2 days. And in some animals, the effects lasted for several days or weeks. So we had something of an analogy to what was claimed to happen in people. To study opiate withdrawal, we administered morphine every day for a week, and we then precipitated withdrawal symptoms by administering an opiate antagonist, namely naltrexone. Naltrexone precipitated withdrawal in the rat consists of a number of rather easily to observe and score signs listed, and the animation keeps going. It's supposed to stop. Anyway, when we administered 18-MC before administering naltrexone, 18-MC attenuated several signs of opiate withdrawal. And a few years before this, we had done a very similar study with ibogaine and had shown very, very similar effects. So in all respects, 18-MC appears to mimic all of the beneficial effects we had earlier shown for ibogaine and very similar to what has been claimed for ibogaine in people. So, 18-MC is potentially effective. It decreases the self-administration of multiple drugs of abuse and attenuates opiate withdrawal. The next question is it safe? What kind of side effects, or does it have side effects? Well, the obvious side effect that we wanted to look at was the neurotoxicity in the cerebellum, because that was what generated a tremendous amount of publicity. We also wanted to look at heart rate and blood pressure, because it's known that ibogaine can produce a bradycardia, and this can be life-threatening if not treated, which I understand is quite easy to treat. We also wanted to get some idea whether 18-MC is likely to produce hallucinations. Now, this is something we won't know until it's given to people, but we have reason to believe that it will not produce the visionary experiences of ibogaine, and I'll get to that in a moment. And lastly, we wanted to know whether 18-MC itself had any addictive potential. To study the neurotoxicity, we did identical studies with 18-MC that we had earlier done with ibogaine, and in fact, we replicated the ibogaine neurotoxicity that was reported by others. At the same dosage, the same treatment schedules, 18-MC had no neurotoxicity. It should also be noted that ibogaine in rats produces whole-body tremors. And at low doses, the tremors are produced, and as the dose gets higher, the tremors actually stop because the neurons are actually being damaged. 18-MC produces neither the tremors, nor does it produce the neurotoxicity. We looked at heart rate and blood pressure. And as expected, ibogaine produced the bradycardia, but did not affect blood pressure. And this again is at huge doses. 18-MC at the same dosage produced neither a change in heart rate nor a change in blood pressure. Now, as I mentioned, we won't know whether 18-MC is hallucinogenic until we give it to a person. However, 18-MC lacks two effects that I believe are fundamentally related to the mechanism by which ibogaine produces these visionary experiences. Namely, ibogaine increases serotonin levels in brain, in part by blocking the serotonin transporter, and it also blocks a particular kind of glutamate receptor called the NMDA receptor, which also happens to be the action of phencyclidine, PCP, angel dust, kind of hallucinogenic agents. It turns out that 18-MC has neither of these actions, and so this is a conjecture hypothesis at this point, but we see no reason why 18-MC will produce hallucinations. If you look at an ibogaine-treated rat, for lack of a better word, the rats look bizarre. If you look at an 18-MC-treated rat, you simply cannot tell him from a vehicle-treated rat. Now, we wanted to know whether 18-MC had any addictive potential of its own, and unfortunately, due to the fact that this isn't the right PowerPoint, you can't see the crucial data, but namely what we did is we trained rats to self-administer cocaine. If you substitute saline for the cocaine on the lower left, what happens is animals have bursts of responses and they extinguish their behavior and they eventually stop responding as they find out that there's no drug to be gotten. When we substituted 18-MC for cocaine, which we did at various dosages of 18-MC, all we saw were patterns of responding that were very similar to saline, and the data are hidden behind this lower right panel here. So you'll have to take my word for it. So 18-MC at this point in time, as far as we know, has no apparent side effects. Unlike ibogaine, it does not induce tremors, does not damage the cerebellum, does not affect heart rate or blood pressure. We believe it won't be hallucinogenic, and is not reinforcing. We've also done some pharmacokinetic studies, and in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over these very quickly. Suffice it to say that 18-MC is eliminated with pharmacokinetics very similar to ibogaine's. The data do not conform to a one-compartment model, and it turns out, like ibogaine, 18-MC is highly sequestered in fat. In fact, even more so than ibogaine, 18-MC levels in fat are about 30-fold higher than any place else, and one possibility for its prolonged effects is that it's stored almost as a depot preparation and then slowly released over time. We eventually identified metabolites in collaboration with a group at the University of Toronto, headed by Ed Sellers, identified 18-hydroxycholinuridine as the major metabolite, which also turns out to be active. However, at least in the rat, we do not believe this contributes very much to 18-MC's pharmacology. Its levels are extremely low, barely measurable. So, how does 18-MC and ibogaine work? Well, one of the first areas that we went to look at, which is certainly is a likely area or a predictable area to look at based on simply what you've heard today, is the dopamine mesolimbic pathway. And that is, does 18-MC interact with the dopamine reward pathways? And we've done several studies of this pathway, but the most important results are shown very soon. To study this pathway, we used a technique called in vivo microdialysis. This is a way of measuring chemistry in the awake and freely moving animal. We implant something called a dialysis probe into the brain, which is can be thought of as a loop of tubing, and the bottom of this loop is constructed of dialysis membrane, and small molecules can pass back and forth. And using this technology, we can measure the release of dopamine and other neurotransmitters, as well as their metabolites in particular brain areas. And when we did this, if you do this with cocaine, not surprisingly, cocaine increases the release of dopamine, blocks the reuptake of dopamine, and raises extracellular levels of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. And that's the black line hidden beyond the orange line on the slide. This would all come out very nicely if we had the right PowerPoint. If you give cocaine repeatedly, what occurs is that you get a sensitization of the dopamine response. And in fact, the sensitization occurs with every drug of abuse. And the particularly perverse aspect of the sensitization is that even though it gets greater as you give the drug of abuse, if you stop giving the drug of abuse and wait a couple weeks, the effect continues to increase and appears to persist for a long period of time, even after discontinuation of the drug of abuse. And if you give a test dose, you will see a whopping dopamine response, and that's the white circles. What we did is we produced a pattern of repeated cocaine administration. to produce the sensitized dopamine response. And then we gave 18-MC prior to the last test dose of cocaine. And what 18-MC did was totally block the sensitization to cocaine. We did a very similar experiment with morphine and got a very similar result. This is very significant conceptually, because sensitization is thought to be the persistent neurochemical change that underlies craving and relapse. In other words, craving and relapse go on, as you know, for years, perhaps forever. And so what biologically oriented basic sciences have done is have tried to conceive of a mechanism that would be responsible for this prolongation of this kind of symptomatology. And there's not complete acceptance of this idea at the clinical level yet, but there is a great deal of basic animal data showing that sensitization is, the degree to which it occurs, is correlated with craving for drugs in animal models of craving. And so we believe what 18-MC essentially does is reset the brain. It takes away this phenomenon that's produced by repeated drug administration and returns it to something of a naive state. Well, the next question was, exactly how does 18-MC do this? So we started on a massive hunt for a mechanism. We did a variety of radioligand binding studies using every ligand we could get a hold of, and this is really a partial list. What was most interesting about what we initially found was what we didn't find. What we didn't find was that 18-MC had no affinity for NMDA glutamate receptors, which ibogaine does, and which some people believe is how ibogaine works. We found that 18-MC has no affinity for serotonin uptake sites, which ibogaine does, and which many believe contributes to its effects. And we also found that 18-MC had very low affinity for a site called the sigma-2 receptor. And this action has been strongly linked to the neurotoxicity produced by ibogaine. So the receptor binding studies, essentially the negative findings actually highlight some effects of 18-MC, which we believe probably are the reason why it's going to be safer. So what does 18-MC do in a positive vein? Well, I mentioned earlier that 18-MC was most effective in blocking self-administration of nicotine. We also found that 18-MC virtually abolished the dopamine response to nicotine. So we started focusing a little bit more on nicotine, particularly nicotine receptors, for which we didn't have a good binding technique to study. We submitted our compound to NIMH, has a psychoactive drug screening program where if you give them their drug, they'll screen it in a variety of receptors. And we did this, and it came back with one positive hit, namely that it blocked a particular type of nicotinic receptor called the alpha-3 beta-4 nicotinic receptor. At about the same time, a patch clamp electrophysiologist joined my department, and we started to study this stuff and study this mechanism in Albany. Patch clamp electrophysiology is a way of studying receptors one at a time in isolated monoclonal generated cells, and it's a way of looking how ligand-gated ion channels work. Namely, these receptors don't work via G proteins, they work via opening particular ion channels, and essentially the receptors are opening, the channels are opening and closing in response to the administration of the agonist, which in this case is acetylcholine, and you can put in a drug and see how it interferes with this process. So to make a long story short, what we replicated was the fact that ibogaine as well as 18-MC blocked alpha-3 beta-4 receptors. Now, the alpha-3 beta-4 receptor is not the major nicotinic receptor in the brain. In fact, it turns out that the major receptor is the alpha-4 beta-2. And this has been more directly related to the reinforcing effects of nicotine, in fact. It turned out that ibogaine blocks the alpha-4 beta-2 receptor as well, but 18-MC does not, and this was quite surprising because most drugs that block ion channels will block many different kinds of ion channels. And it turned out that 18-MC was really quite selective about which ion channel it blocked. So the next issue was, well, where are these receptors? If they're not the major receptor of the brain, in fact, they're not in the nucleus accumbens or the ventral tegmental area, or if they're there, they're there in very, very low amounts. It turns out that most of the alpha-3 beta-4 receptors in the brain are preferentially located in two places, in the medial habenula and the interpeduncular nucleus. And in fact, there's a cholinergic acetylcholine-containing pathway that connects the two called the habenulo-interpeduncular pathway. The medial habenula projects to the interpeduncular nucleus. It also turns out that there are many ways in which this habenulo-interpeduncular pathway can interact with the dopamine system. In fact, in the early 80s, there was a sizable literature on this pathway, and it was actually referred to as an alternate reward pathway. It was shown that animals would electrically self-stimulate this pathway just as they would self-stimulate the dopamine pathway, and that if you damage this pathway, the dopamine pathway, animals would activate the dopamine pathway even more, and conversely, if you damage the dopamine pathway, animals would self-stimulate the benign interpeduncular pathway more. After the discovery and the importance of dopamine became really the fashion of, towards the middle and end of the 80s, this other pathway was virtually ignored, and it's hard to find a reference to it in the last 20 years. What we believe is the case is that AT-MC, as well as possibly ibogaine, works in this pathway to block these particular receptors, and this pathway actually dampens the dopamine pathway. And the reason we believe that AT-MC works against multiple forms of drug abuse is that it's not working directly at one spot in the dopamine pathway, it's working outside it and dampening the whole system. So the last thing we wanted to look at was, can we provide any evidence that blocking this pathway, blocking this receptor, is indeed relevant to the anti-addictive effects of this drug? We've taken three general approaches. The first approach was to use existing agents. Namely, there are three other agents that, in fact, have all been at the market at one time, that block alpha-3-4 receptors. And these are mecamelamine, which is the non-specific nicotinic antagonist, bupropion, which is actually used to treat smoking as well as depression, and dextromethorphan, which is the active ingredient in every over-the-counter cough medicine. These three agents, along with AT-MC, all have a variety of different actions. The only action they have in common is to block alpha-3-beta-4 receptors. So we came up with this idea that if we give low doses of any two of these four agents, we'll get additivity at the common site of action, but we won't see other effects attributable to their unique actions that aren't shared by each other. And when we did this, and you can't see the real data here, but it looks just like the next data, we did this on morphine, on methamphetamine, and nicotine self-administration. And in each case, low-dose combinations of any two of these agents, and it worked with all six combinations, decreased self-administration of morphine, methamphetamine, and nicotine at doses which were inactive alone. And when we did it on responding for water, they had no effect. The second thing which we started to do more recently is to inject 18-MC directly into the brain. And we've injected 18-MC directly into the interpeduncular nucleus, and we've reduced morphine self-administration. And most recently, we haven't even graphed the data yet, 18-MC injected into the habenula as well as the interpeduncular nucleus, we've recently found to block the sensitized dopamine response to morphine. So we believe, maybe the mechanism isn't exactly the way we propose it to be, but we believe that these drugs, and our drug, is indeed acting in this habenula interpeduncular pathway. Lastly, our collaborator in Vermont recently synthesized a number of 18-MC congeners, and they were tested in vitro for the alpha-3-4-beta antagonist potency, and then we tested them in vivo, and for both morphine and methamphetamine self-administration, there was a pretty decent correlation between their potencies to block alpha-3-beta-4 receptors and their effects to decrease drug self-administration. So is 18-MC blockade of alpha-3-beta-4 receptors relevant? We believe it is. Combinations of low doses will decrease drug self-administration. If we inject 18-MC into the interpeduncular nucleus, it decreases morphine self-administration, and we get pretty good correlations between alpha-3-beta-4 antagonist potency and their in vivo effects. In conclusion, we believe that 18-MC will be useful in treating many forms of drug addiction. We believe it will lack all of ibogaine's prominent or at least publicized side effects. We believe it abolishes dopamine sensitization, and this may underlie craving, its effects to prevent craving and relapse. And we believe we've discovered or rediscovered a novel mechanism for affecting the reward system. Lastly, a clinical application, the three other drugs we've used, namely bupropion, dextromethorphan, and mecamelamine, are in fact available, and it would be a far easier task to set up a clinical trial of looking at the drug combinations in various human addictive disorders. And my hope is, and I may inspire maybe one of you to undertake this and to begin a clinical study, because this is something which is indeed very doable and probably fairly quickly. Lastly, I just want to acknowledge my collaborators. Islam Ezanouv, who is here, has been my close collaborator and colleague for the last more than 10 years and a lot of years. And she's also, by the way, responsible for making this presentation. And it's just too bad you can't see the beautiful animation she produced. Martin Kuna is a medicinal chemist at the University of Vermont who really made all this possible. The other investigators in my department, they all played different roles. Lindsay Huff did the pharmacokinetics. Milt Teitler and Kathy Davis did the receptor binding stuff. Helen Molinari was a wonderful neuroanatomist who unfortunately died at a young age of colon cancer. And the last major study she did were the neurotoxicity studies with ibogaine and 18-MC. Lastly, Mark Fleck is the patch plant electrophysiologist. Thank you very much. Isabel, stand up.